Would you please rise and join me in the Pledge of Allegiance?
Pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America. To the Republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Roll call of members, please. Mr. Dennis?
I'm here.
Ms. Herrera has asked to be excused. Ms. Kiefer?
Present.
Mr. Lane?
Here.
Ms. McAsee?
Here.
Mrs. McBean Claiborne?
Present.
Mr. McKenna?
Here.
Mr. Proto?
Here.
Ms. Pryor?
Here.
Mr. Robison?
Here.
Mr. Shinagawa? Mr. Stein?
Here. Here.
Mr. Burbank?
Here.
Ms. Cha?
I'm here.
Ms. Robertson?
Here.
13 members present. Thank you. I have one proclamation for Latino Heritage Month. Is there anyone here to accept it? Oh, Fernando, great. Come on up. Whereas Tompkins County is the home to an active, growing, and civically engaged Latino community, and whereas this year Tompkins County is proud to join the President of the United States in recognition of the Latino residents of our community and nation for their profound contributions to our society at large, and whereas virtually every aspect of our community's life has been influenced by Latinos, whether in arts, culture, medicine, government, business, or volunteerism, and whereas the 400-year-old Latino culture, steeped in tradition and centered around principles of family and community, strengthens the fabric of our entire society, now therefore I, Martha Robertson, Chair of the Tompkins County Legislature, do hereby proclaim the month of September 15, 2010 through October 15, 2010 as Latino Heritage Month in the County of Tompkins, and together with our entire community join in celebration and recognition of the Latino community and salute the Latino Civic Association for its outstanding work on behalf of the Latinos throughout Central New York. So this is for you, Fernanda. Do you want to say a few words?
Well, yes. I want to thank you very much for the proclamation. And I'd also like to invite you. We're going to have our main event this year. It's going to be September 25th at the Women's Community Building. We will have a celebration of immigration. We've heard a lot of negative things about immigration, a lot of debate, and I think we want to highlight the positive aspects of immigration and the hard work of folks who come here to this country to make a living for themselves and to make our whole nation a better place. So we'll be celebrating on the 25th in the evening, 7:30 to midnight, and I invite everybody here and the general public to attend, and I'll tell you that that event in part is being made possible by your help through the tourism grants, the celebration grants. So thank you for that, too.
Thank you very much, Fernanda. Proclamations, petitions, communications, and notices.
Communications are on the desk.
And I would like to announce that we will not have an executive session tonight. Privilege of the floor for the public. I have some people who've signed up. Your time limit is 3 minutes. Please come to the microphone and state where your name and where you live. And if we get through the list, if anybody else would like to speak, you can also take a turn. Start with Royal Cole and then go to David Stewart.
My name is Roy Coley from 121 Pine Tree Road. I'm one of the representatives here from the Pine Tree Road Residents Association. We're concerned about the quality of life in our Pine Tree Road neighborhood, which we believe is threatened by some aspects of the Pine Tree Road pedestrian and bicycle project. That county plan will allow and promote the flow of traffic of large trucks through our residential neighborhood. I'd like to address how we have looked at previous threats to our neighborhood And briefly, I'll tell you about something that happened 10 years ago. There was a piece of land between Pine Tree Road and Eastern Heights that was a farm, and it went on the market, and we perceived a threat there of some mass dense housing similar to what you find not far from East Hill Plaza today. What we did was to get together in somebody's kitchen, and we agreed that some of us would buy the plot of land and then sell off immediately small pieces behind each house, so each house would have more protection from anything that might happen there in the future. That worked very well. That was 10 years ago. 7 years ago, we took another step. Those of us who still retained ownership of the large piece donated that land to the town. And that land is presently the East Hill Nature Preserve. And one of the conditions of the gift was that it would remain ever wild. So we were concerned about the quality of life in the neighborhood, and we did something about it. And so our actions now reflect our continued concern about the quality of life in the neighborhood. And you will, at some point, receive a petition from us in which we ask you to recognize the threat to this quality of life in the Pine Tree Road neighborhood. Thank you.
Thank you. David Stewart, to be followed by Mary Margaret Carmichael and Kathy Covert. Our clerk has the time cards up for you. So.
Thank you. I am David Stewart. I live at 119 Pine Tree Road, right next to Roy Coley. He was one of my professors when I first came to town 47 years ago, and now I'm his neighbor. And that neighbor term is important to us on Pine Tree Road. It is a residential zone. While the name of the road is Pine Tree Road, it is more akin to that of a city street in a very dense residential area. In fact, in about 0.6 miles, we have many more homes than some other city streets. We have more homes, and we have more traffic than Forest Home, where I understand there is some traffic calming steps being taken. We have more traffic going through our area than Forest Home does, so clearly we need some traffic calming approaches. The Sheriff's Department and Sheriff Meskel have been very helpful with occasional radar traps, but that's occasional. They can't be there all the time. But people do speed there quite frequently. It's a posted 35-mile-an-hour zone, but people go 50 miles an hour through there. When you ask them to slow down, what you get is half a peace sign back from the drivers. And if that's the attitude of the drivers who are going through there all the time, that's not helpful to people who have young children, to the elderly who live there. I've only been there 7.5 years, but it is a residential area that is important to us. We want to keep it that way, and we believe that there should be more traffic calming measures that would help ensure that the neighborhood stays that way. Thank you.
Thank you. Mary Margaret Carmichael, and then Lucia Scorey. I'm very sorry about the names here.
Mary Margaret Carmichael, 122 Pine Tree Road, Ithaca. I have been a resident and homeowner on Pine Tree Road for 48 years, since 1962. Almost all homes are owner-occupied. This is a neighborhood. Pine Tree is a county road, thus a part of your concerns. Please do not allow the railroad underpass at Pine Tree and Route 366 to be raised. This would allow and encourage larger trucks and larger construction equipment to travel on Pine Tree Road. There is already far too much speeding traffic on this road. I suggest you make Pine Tree a no-through trucks road. Reroute trucks from Richford on Route 38 to Dryden, then on Route 13 either to Ithaca and Lansing or on Route 366 to Cornell University. Then the raising of the underpass would not be needed. Again, please do not raise the height of the underpass. Let's work together to alleviate the traffic problem rather than make it worse. Thank you.
Thank you. Lucia Scorey, and J. Robert Cook is next.
Hi, my name is Lucia Scorey. I live at 124 Pine Tree Road. And I want to start out by saying they did it with smoke and mirrors. I want you to know I do not object to local trucks transporting goods to and from East Hill Plaza. I do not object to buses, commuter traffic, and local delivery trucks. I'm not against planned and responsible growth of commerce. I am very pleased with the benefits that Cornell University has given this community. I do, however, object to the way in which Pine Tree Road bicycle and pedestrian path project was planned. Misinformation was presented to multiple government planners when money for the project was requested over 2 years ago. Here are a few of the misinformation that was presented to you and to other agencies. Pine Tree Road is inhabited primarily by students. That's wrong. It is a high-density community inhabited primarily by owner-occupied homes. Another error. There was support from the residents. That's another wrong statement. The residents were first informed of this project in June of 2010. The third one. The primary purpose of this project was to, quote, for the enhancement of the environment, unquote. The primary purpose of this project was to rebuild the bridge to allow for faster, larger, and heavier trucks to traverse between 79 and Cornell, rather than use currently approved state roads. I recommend that monies granted to this project be refunded. The grant money was given based on erroneous information and without input from the residents who would be most affected by these changes. They did it with smoke and mirrors.
J. Robert Cook and then Krista Bissell.
I'm Bob Cook. Nancy and I have lived on Pine Tree Road for the last 44 years, and we are here with the group to ask for your assistance in finding some way to meet the transportation needs of the county without sacrificing our neighborhood in the process. Pine Tree Road's been a good place for us to have our family, but I must confess that over the 44 years, the volume and speed of the traffic has increased rather markedly. We have two grandchildren also living on Pine Tree Road, along with about 15 to 24 other public school kids who catch the bus and live in that area. So it also poses a problem for our leaving from our driveways. It's fast enough and dangerous enough that it's an obstacle course for us. And we are deeply concerned that the changes that are being proposed will likely have the consequence of increasing the amount of traffic instead of reducing it. In fact, the removal of the bridge in your documents was characterized as an obstacle to truck traffic. So we hope that you will not produce approve changes that will diminish our neighborhood. But instead, we suggest some steps such as the following. Allegedly, the bridge was to be removed so there would be space for the sidewalk and bike path. It would be an easy matter to move that bike and pedestrian path to start at Judd Falls on 366 and cross the creek and go to the Sizer facility on Pine Tree Road. There's no rule that says the sidewalks have to follow mindlessly with that pathway. So if that were the case, you wouldn't need to move the bridge to get it wide enough for the traffic. We would like full traffic lights at each end of the street. It really is scary getting through those intersections at each end, and you have to take your chances. We hope that you would reduce the speed limit to 30 and that you would add other measures that would help us keep the speed under control. Thank you.
Thank you. Krista Bissell, then Louise Buck.
Hi, I'm Krista Bissell. I'm from 137 Pine Tree Road. I've been a resident of Pine Tree for 26 years. I do have the petition that somebody talked about. Over this short holiday weekend, we actually had 50 residents from our road sign the petition, which I will present to you, as well as a letter which tells a little bit about our district, and it also gives some requests for traffic calming. Our neighborhood, we're talking about an area that's about 7/10 of a mile with 49 homes on it. 90% of those, over 90%, are owner-occupied. We have at least 17 to 20 children in that short distance. We are a highly occupied residential area that's not unlike areas like 366, where the speed was just reduced to 30 miles an hour. We need help from the county. We do not need somebody making a decision to make living on Pine Tree Road more difficult for all of us. Thank you, and I will submit these when I know who to submit them to. Thank you.
You could, you just have one copy of the whole thing? You could pass that up. Thank you. Louise Buck and then Jacqueline Wakula.
I'm Louise Buck, 143 Pine Tree Road. I moved to Pine Tree Road 6 years ago, basically to escape the truck traffic on State Street. And I found among the residents when I left there a very coherent community. There was a lot of what I call in my work social capital resident in this community, and that was evidenced by the action that Roy Coley spoke of earlier. They had just formed the East Hill Preserve in collaboration with the county. And during my 6 years there have been many other bits of evidence that this is a very coherent community, very worthy of preserving as a coherent community, in my opinion, because we have the capacity and the interest and the will to work with our community leadership at all levels to try to create better solutions to the what I might call ominous threat of very significantly not only increased volume of truck traffic, but the nature of the trucks that could start coming through there will have very significant noise impacts on us. And that concerns me a great deal, not only for people, but for pets and wildlife and pets and wildlife as well. So I'd like to offer my own personal will to work with every type of task force or committee might be formed to work on some of the solutions we've proposed here. And we really are approaching you in a spirit of cooperation and problem solving. Thank you.
Thank you. Jacqueline Wakula and then Liz Zopp.
Thank you. I'm Jackie Wakula. My husband and I live at 204 Pine Tree Road. We've been there 38 years. And once again, the residents of Pine Tree Road have come together to preserve their neighborhood. We are all united in wishing to reduce the current speed limit and limit truck traffic through our neighborhood. The residents have watched helplessly as every season brings property damage, automobile accidents, personal injury, and danger to children. This narrow residential street is not suitable for the type and amount of truck and automobile traffic that currently traverses Pine Tree Road. It's really a plague to us, and we are asking for relief. Thank you.
Thank you. Liz Zopp, and then Beth Gerard.
Hi, I'm Liz Zopp at 151 Pine Tree Road. We actually just moved in June, and our neighbors have been very welcoming, so thank you. I would never come to speak at something like this because I'm usually a nervous wreck, but something happened last week that I needed to share in support of the safety measures they want to take. My two boys, 4 and 2 years old, we were crossing at the crosswalk at Hannes, and the courteous driver slowed down and stopped for us to cross at the crosswalk. But someone driving behind this woman was speeding up, and I thought was going to ram her from behind. But instead, he sped up, went around her, so if I had entered the crosswalk, we would have been hit. And if I wasn't with my children, they wouldn't have been seen. They're too short. Obviously, this isn't a place where you walk without a parent, but it was just a scary incident that happened that prompted me to come and show my support for the safety precautions. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Beth Gerard and then Joan Fardman.
I mostly am here to reiterate what my neighbors have said, but I just wanted to put another residential face on the picture. We moved to Pine Tree Road 7 years ago, but my husband actually grew up on Pine Tree Road, and we live next door to his grandparents, Robert and Nancy Cook. We have two children who have been going outside to the school bus every day during the school year. Luckily, the school bus drivers agree to stop in front of each of our homes, because it is so difficult for us to get down the road when there are huge snow drifts and the cars are driving so fast that they agree that it's not safe for the kids to walk on the side of the road. I wanted to say today that while initially we were very supportive of the idea of an increased pedestrian bicycle relationship between Cornell and East Hill Plaza, we think that a thoughtful development of that makes a lot of sense, not only for Cornell, but also for our community. However, the one point that I really want to make is that as much as I'm concerned about the railroad bridge and the increase in traffic, I honestly think that much of the traffic is already there. I was at the intersection of what is Mitchell and Ellis Hollow Road, depending on which direction you go, in Pine Tree today, and I watched a double tractor truck make that turn, and he was going off Pine Tree Road, so he had just come down from 79, and he headed up Ellis Hollow Road, and just because this is on my mind, I thought, well, where is he going? And he went up Ellis Hollow Road and turned on Game Farm Road and went, you know, from Game Farm wherever he needed to go next. He can't get under the bridge, but he's already coming down Pine Tree Road. And so my point is that we already have an unmanageable level of truck traffic on our road, and this, I think, was just the straw that broke the camel's back as far as bringing our community together to say, you know what, this is a really difficult problem for a group of people who are very connected. We're not just, you know, a set of transient renters or temporary homeowners. These are people who have lived here for years, and we, my husband and I, chose to move here exactly for that feel of the community. I mean, they still call our house Allison Casaret's house, even though we've lived there for 7 years. So just wanted to add that.
Thank you. Joan Fartman, as the last person who signed up.
Good evening. I am here for a different reason than my predecessors. My name is Joan Fardman. I'm the Executive Director of the Advocacy Center of Tompkins County. And I'm here to give you a short statement about what our agency does and the impact that it has on the community. I am going to be reading my statement, but I also handed in copies of them so that you can have these to look at if you need to or want to. The mission of the Advocacy Center is to prevent and reduce sexual and domestic abuse through supportive services and education in our community. Our agency is a private not-for-profit serving victims of crime, and the groups of crime victims that we serve are youth victims of child sexual abuse, adult survivors of child sexual abuse, adult victims of domestic violence, youth witnesses to domestic violence, teen dating violence victims, and adult sexual assault victims. And the agency has been doing this for the last 33 years, although we did add some of those populations along the way. One of our major programs is the Emergency Shelter for Victims of Domestic Violence, and it's one that people think of most often when they talk about our agency. And the reason is that we have lots of needs for the people who use those services, and it's something that's visual to the community, that kind of a program. However, this program has the fewest number of people that we serve in a year. During 2009, we saw 1,071 direct service clients, including 80 shelter clients, and provided 210 prevention education presentations to 3,600 members of the Tompkins County community. Our support and advocacy to all of the above-mentioned victims groups include the following specific services: a 24-hour hotline service, telephone and in-person counseling and support services, both short and long-term, transportation and accompaniment to services such as court proceedings, police interviews, legal appointments, DSS team meetings, sexual assault nurse examiners, exams at Cayuga Medical Center, medical appointments, etc. Also liaison with other service providers on the case of our particular clients. We run at the current time 5, but sometimes up to 8 support and recovery groups for youth, adult women, and mixed sex adult groups. Information and referral to other services, assisting with filing crime victim claims, education and advocacy center library access to materials about sexual abuse and domestic violence for victims, parents, partners, and community members. And we work in collaboration with, and here's a short list of the groups that we work with, the Family Treatment Court, the Integrated Domestic Violence Court, DSS Supervised Visitation Program, and the new FAR Family Assessment Response Alternative to Child Protective Services Program, and Family and Children's Services, as well as many of the schools in the community. While many of our services are crisis-oriented, we also have clients that we have long-term relationships with, because even when crisis is present, one intervention is not enough to deal with the recovery and ongoing crisis from a lot of the events that I was mentioning, or the types of victimizations. One outcome that we look to achieve is that a family will have a long-term success in keeping themselves and all of the members of their family safe from abuse. Thank you. That's my statement.
Thank you very much, Joan. And we'll hand out, Kathy will put the your statement in people's mailboxes after the meeting. Now, if those are all the folks who have signed up, if there's anybody else who would like to speak, just make your way to the microphone. All right, thank you all for coming. Legislator, privilege of the floor. Are there any legislators who'd like to address the public? Frank.
Thank you, Madam Chair. just a couple of announcements for you this evening. The never-ending battle with NYSEG and the proposed rate increases, they're still under scrutiny. But the decision that the PSC is chewing on right now will have an increase of about $16 to $19 per household.
I can't hear, Frank.
I don't think your microphone's on.
It's on.
It's on.
All right.
Well, come here. Let's wait just a second. What I was saying, Peter, was NYSEG rate increase case is still going on, and the average increase that they're looking at is $16 to $19 per household. It's not over yet. If you want to weigh in, there's still an opportunity to get a hold of the Public Service Commission. The only other announcement I'd like to make right now is just another reminder that the watch fire that the Vietnam veterans are sponsoring again out at the Myers Point is the 17th of September, and it'll start at dusk, and I hope many of you can make it. Mike Lane makes it every year. Thank you.
Frank, that increase, is that per month?
Yeah. That's what I read was
$16 to $19 a month per family. Okay. Thank you.
That's what's proposed.
Right.
It's not done yet.
Thank you. Nathan.
And how much is 1% of our levy for a household, per 100,000, let's say?
1% on the levy.
$6?
It's $6 a thousand, isn't it?
Right.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Right.
Okay. Just curious. That's all.
Okay. Thank you. That was a trick. I thought that was a trick question.
Is that a trick question?
Thanks, Nathan. Dooley.
Hearing the Pine Tree Road residents speak tonight reminded me, and I'm sorry if they've all gone, Dick Fisher, late Cornell professor, lived on Pine Tree Road, and he was very knowledgeable about birds. He was probably our first and greatest local environmental person. But he had suggested a long time ago that the property owners along Pine Tree Road on the east side could use their back property lines for pedestrian path. And it was interesting to hear a version of that come back up now, because that was a long time ago.
Thank you. Anyone else? Carol.
Yeah. I want to recognize the Ithaca Farmers Market and talk just a little bit about the early and important City of Ithaca support for it. And if people saw in today's Ithaca Journal that the Ithaca Farmers Market has been selected, actually voted, by more than 50,000 voters from across the country as one of America's favorite farmers markets, the third most popular farmers market in New York State, and one of the national top 20. It opened in 1973 and often attracts more than 5,000 customers per day. And I was remembering when I saw this, study that it was one of my very first paid gigs as a planner was by the City of Ithaca Planning Department asked me to do a study of a market study, market analysis of the farmers market, who was coming, where were they coming from, what was bringing them there, in preparation to look at the parking needs and the expansion needs and whether this was going to be a lasting enough phenomenon to give the kind of support it would need to grow into something. And so I just wanted to note it and congratulate the farmers market at achieving this milestone. Thanks.
Thank you, Carol. Anyone else? Mike.
Last Thursday night in Dryden, we had what I think was the fourth of the budget outreach sessions sponsored by the legislators trying to talk about the budget issues that we're going to be facing here starting right away. And it was Martha, you, and Brian, and I were out at the Dryden Community Cafe. We had about 30 people come to that. We had a great, interesting conversation. We had the presentation. I want to really thank Marsha Lynch for working with us to get the publicity out there, which I thought was very good, and certainly Joe Mariana for coming out and being there to back us up, answer questions, and, of course, our being able to use the PowerPoint that County Administration put together for us. I thought the questions were very good. We heard a lot of comments about trying to preserve youth services. We heard a lot of comments about folks being overtaxed. And I think just between those two, we know what the issues we have in the county to face. Cuts or taxes are difficult issues. But it was a good session. I know there's been other ones sponsored by the other legislators ahead of that. I don't think there's any planned after this, but we'll be getting in, of course, to the legislature's budget forum later this month.
Thank you, Mike. Will.
Thank you, Martha. About a week or so ago, my wife and I took a little trip down to the Central Hudson region, and the highlight of our trip was crossing a new linear park that's only about 6 months old. It is a pedestrian bridge that crosses the Hudson River. It is over a mile long. It is the longest pedestrian bridge in the world. And I was stunned at how beautiful it was and how incredibly popular it was. There were hundreds of people, all ages, ethnicities, just an amazing variety of people just getting out on the river to walk across it. And I mention this just because I know sometimes in these hard budgetary times we question the need for trails and pedestrian and cycling amenities, but if ever you want to be inspired, go across the walkway across the Hudson. You can bike or walk. And secondly, this coming weekend, on Saturday the 11th, is the annual AIDS Ride for Life. And if you haven't been training, it's probably a little too late to sign up now, but there are many riders that would love to have support. It's a great cause, and I am really delighted that it's continuing. Thank you.
Thank you, Will. Anyone else? Peter.
I just thought it was worthwhile bringing to your attention something that my wife and I did on last Saturday night. We went to the opening of the new kitchen theater on the west side of, on the west end of State Street to see a performance of Private Lives. And my wife and I are theater goers, and we go to a lot of theater. We've been to theater all around the world. And Private Lives is one of my favorites. I think I've probably seen it at least three times before that. And I'll tell you that that new kitchen theater, which we as a county supported heavily, I believe, was worth every penny we put into it. It's a magnificent venue. I've been in a lot of theaters, and I think it compares equally, if not better, than most of the off-Broadway performance spaces in New York City. It's a magnificent place. It's comfortable, it's welcoming, it's light, it's lovely. And the performance that we saw of Private Lives, as far as I'm concerned, was as good as anything we've seen. And one of the things we saw before was off-Broadway, and another performance we saw was in London, and this matched it. For those of you who don't know the story, I recommend you go. It's a lovely romantic comedy about the bumps or the ups and downs of a bumpy romance, and it talks about second chances and even third chances, and it's great. So I recommend you all see it and go look at this this theater space and be proud of what that tourist money did.
Thank you, Peter. Dave.
Yeah, I'd like to invite everybody to come out to Newfield Old Home Days this weekend and enjoy the parade on Saturday morning and enjoy the festivities. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Anyone else? All right, well, the next item on our agenda is another presentation by a department head. Sheriff Peter Meskel has a presentation and annual report and, I believe, some handouts for us. Welcome, Peter.
Thanks, Martha. There should be on your desk a copy of the annual report, and inside it there should be a PowerPoint walk-along. The PowerPoint is probably much longer than you want to endure, and I've been given time for, so I'm going to try to go through it in an abbreviated fashion. Choose to follow that or just listen along and watch the slides. With me tonight is Correction Officer Jeff Potter. Jeff is Correction Officer with us for, what, over 15 years now? 18. Time flies when you're having fun. And he also works on our reentry program, and he's a fantastic graphic artist and a computer whiz, so that's why one of the reasons why he's here tonight. But the thing I'd like to point out on the cover of the report, if you have the actual one, is a picture probably about 2 weeks before I was born of Sheriff Bob Howard, and I think it's Deputy Stark, one of his good friends that was with him investigating an accident. Just, we try to change the cover up and do different things with it, and we thought we'd go backwards. We have this picture actually hanging up in our meeting and conference room at the Sheriff's Office, along with some older pictures that we discovered and tried to preserve. So, in any event, go ahead to the next slide, Jeff. In essence, our mission statement is well documented in every annual report we've done, and as well as the presentation tonight. But we try to be an active participant in building and strengthening community partnerships, working with everybody to foster better public safety. And we try to promote and encourage concepts of development in new directions and try to make a difference in our community wherever we can. And we try to empower all of our employees at all levels to do the same thing. The next slide is a highlight of some of the things in my letter. For the first time ever in 2009, our jail was accredited. 166 standards, have to be met. They have to be sure that the policy and the practice are one and the same. Jeff also works on the accreditation program and the maintenance of those accreditation files. So he can tell you that this was a real bear, a lot of work by a lot of people in the Sheriff's Office Correction Division, and I'm thankful to all of them because everybody worked on it, everybody bought into it, and it's a practice of how we do our daily lives in the operation. We're working, and I've been a founding member of the LETS group, Law Enforcement Technology Something Training Sharing Services. Essentially, the group is law enforcement administrators or their designees working together so we can share technology and share information. And we've come a long way. A couple months ago, you granted us the money necessary to purchase new software for CAD system and for updating our records management system countywide. It will not only help the Sheriff's Office, but it will allow each law enforcement agency to share data live in real time. And I think those savings from an efficiency standpoint of an investigating a crime, as well as from a management and administrative point of view, are really going to make a big difference down the road once we get the system up and running. Thanks to Greg Potter and Kim Moore and other people at ITS who have really done, Lee Shurtleff, who have done the yeoman's work on this. We start meeting next week to tell them exactly what we want, what we don't want, and the first phase of this is scheduled to be implemented in December. And just to reiterate what you all know, and the county administrator is going to give you a very detailed and interesting message tonight about the budget, we are in tough times. We do the best with what you give us, and we try to provide first-rate professional public service and safety throughout the county. So. A couple other highlights. The grant money, we received grant money to purchase new rifles. That was a joint grant we did with Ithaca City Police Department. They were actually able to purchase a vehicle, and we were actually able to purchase patrol rifles. We work together pretty closely with the City of Ithaca Police Department, and it's a great benefit to every resident of the county. We automated the TRACS program. It's an automated program we started, and we've continued, again, working with ITS. It allows us to efficiently file reports, accident reports, and traffic tickets in particular. The other thing that I would highlight to you that really isn't done is the Sheriff's Office renovation. We actually moved the civil and the records division together in 2009. It's a very small dollar amount renovation, but a very important change in our agency because everybody is working on being cross-trained. And unfortunately, we lost one of our clerks to retirement after 30-some years of service to the county this summer, so we're doing more with less. And I'm very thankful that Undersheriff Tubbs had the foresight to put this program and plan together because it's really helped us get by at the time. Quickly, a highlight of grant money, selective traffic enforcement program, child safety seats, seatbelt enforcement, homeland security money for both equipment and for a mobile command unit. In the public safety meeting today, there was another homeland security monies approved or authorized in excess of $200,000. All that money we're going to use towards this new computer system that we're all going to use and be more efficient with. A quick outline of the budget, and I will tell you, and I'll take full responsibility for it, there are a couple numbers that are off. It's simply simple math. It's not percentage calculations in the pie chart. If you're looking closely at the report, whether you're looking at it online, by a few thousand dollars, and I apologize for that. That's my error, my responsibility. We were pushing to get this out. It's later than it should have been, but because of the loss of staff, we've had to do other things that were a bigger priority. But in any event, this is a pie chart that shows you our budget and our budget in relation to the entire county budget. We represent approximately 4% of the local share of the budget. And this slide is the other side of it, which is the revenue side. As you can see, the revenue in the smaller chart and the expenditures in the blue, just to give you a correlation of how much revenue we bring in throughout the Sheriff's Office during the course of the year. And this one breaks down revenue in just a further fashion, where the revenue from the civil office, the revenue from the jail and the revenue from the law enforcement division is the largest amount of revenue. Next slide just furthers that, and I'm not going to go into that. If people have specific questions, I'd be happy to try to answer that. The Rural Patrol Division of the Sheriff's Office, when it's fully staffed, the sheriff, the undersheriff, the captain, six sergeants, and 25 deputies. We cover, as you can see on the map, a large area with a lake coming down through the middle of it. And they're responsible for law enforcement, both reactive and preventive, throughout the county. Some of the community events that we attended in 2009 are listed up here. We really believe it's important to do our very best with the limited resources and budget that you give us. We're appreciative of it, but we think it's really important whenever possible to get out to these events and interact with our community, find out what the community needs, and show them who we are and what we do and how we do it. Some of the enforcement programs we do, we have a low-profile unit. We had one when I first started. We actually created one first year I became sheriff, and we let it go for a few years because we were simply overwhelmed with answering calls, and we've since tried to shift law enforcement personnel around a little where we can provide some additional services in relation to traffic safety over the last few years. So we marked up a car in a low-profile fashion. It has one of the license plate readers on it that we got from a grant from New York State that can read all the plates. In fact, last night at about midnight, one of the deputies on the 11-7 shift had a hit on that right in downtown Ithaca, made a stop on a stolen vehicle and made a good clean arrest and got the people's vehicle back to them. We've involved in Operation Safe Stop as well, where we try to target school zones and high complaint areas with kids getting on and off buses throughout the county. And the Buckle Up New York program, you can see the statistics as far as the number of hours. We did a couple of checkpoints and we issued several tickets. The same with the STEP and the STOP WI program. What I'd like to point out in the STEP program, that's a selective traffic enforcement program, a grant we get from New York State. We actually have, in the last 4 or 5 years, tried to make a real precision model out of focusing on areas where we've had high accident rates or high complaint rates or both, and focused our energy on attacking that in a law enforcement, education, and awareness, kind of a three-way model to make a difference. And the statistics prove that when we put extra enforcement in target areas, it actually reduces accident injuries. And from my two cents and the philosophy that I try to impart in all of our staff is that that's what we should be doing with traffic tickets. Traffic tickets should be to deter aggressive driving and bad behavior on the roads to reduce accidents, injuries, and death. The other enforcement news, while that's a picture of our trailer, STOP WI gave us a grant last year for a much smaller portable pole sign that allows us to move it around easily in other areas, and we're collecting data on that now and trying to put together a program with ITS, but we've got them so busy with our records management system that we've had to kind of put that on hold for a little while. We're hoping to move forward with that in an innovative way and be able to take complaints from neighbors in areas, actually put the sign up for a week, collect the data, and then report back to those area neighbor residents, representatives, what we found. The other thing that we've been involved in heavily over the last half a dozen years now is the activity up in South Hill with Ithaca College residents. We don't get involved too much in Cornell unless the city needs additional help, but our main focus is on the South Hill and the traffic, and I think we've done a really good job at trying to remind students that they're neighbors with the rest of their neighbors, and then when that doesn't work, we enforce the law, and that's gone along very well, and the neighbors are very appreciative of it. Specialized assignment, we have an accident reconstruction team. There's 7 members of the sheriff's office that are on the team. They have to go through at least 4 weeks of training. We've started to cross-train with the Ithaca City accident team, and we're hoping to, by next year, actually start working on incidents together and combine our resources that same way, because they have some accidents that we don't deal with, and conversely, we have some that they don't normally see, and it makes all of us better, and it uses money more efficiently. The child passenger safety seat's another grant that we get. We checked 201 car seats, and as you can see, we replaced 156, and only 12% of the seats that came in were installed correctly. This is a program we've been doing for 10 or 11 years now. It's a great community service program that several of the deputies are trained to do. They do a great job with it, and it serves the community well. Our DARE car, it's a picture of it. If you haven't seen it, I think it went in service about the end of December in 2009. We actually did increase our DARE program in the three schools that we still do the DARE program from 12 to 16 weeks because we added lessons about domestic violence and about abuse and about violence in general because we thought that was an important thing to convey to people while we have them in a captive audience. Our canine operation, the picture to the left was our, well, actually the picture to the right was Deputy Jim Nemai, who's now retired. His wife Deb is the Chief of Corrections with his dog Ruger. And then to the left was Boyar, a dog that we purchased in 2000. And Boyar passed away. And we now have, although I don't think we have a picture of Major, who's a Belgian Malinois, who was trained in patrol work and drug trafficking. And if you've ever seen Major, he's a very friendly dog and very interactive with the community and kids. Our Marine Patrol, this, keep in mind these are statistics from 2009. That we spent 411 hours out on the lake, did some searches, some vehicle inspections, issued a lot of warnings. In 2010, we've only been on the lake four or five times, basically two holiday weekends, the one just passed, July 4th weekend, and two swim events, the triathlon and the women's swim event. We've really cut that patrol back due to the cutbacks in the budget. The SWAT team is the city team that we have four deputies that we serve with them. It's a great team that we've been doing since, I think, 2002 or 2003 when we formed that agreement. It provides SWAT services throughout the county. When the incident's outside the city, it's commanded by myself, the undersheriff, or the captain. When the incident's in the city, it's commanded by the city police. And it's a really great service. They're a great group of people that work really hard. We've never had any accidents, injuries, or deaths related to any type of SWAT issue. And I think that's an important thing to bring out because these are high-risk type events, and the team is a team of highly trained professionals that do their job, take it very seriously. Criminal Investigation Unit, we were involved in 334 complaints. There's a list of major cases that we were involved in. There's a total of five people that worked there, one senior investigator and four investigators. We also work with sex offender registration, and you'll see that up on our website if you ever go to our website and check it out. And we're also involved with the New York State Police, with the Civil Air Patrol, and with the Ithaca City Police in narcotics work as we have time. Our records division, as you can see, we processed 11,900, almost 12,000 incidents last year, had to manually process arrests. We're hoping that that's going to change, and in a year or two, when I'm up here presenting it to you, I'm going to tell you how wonderful it is and how that change is. But in any event, our division is very busy, and it processes a number of reports in a short amount of time. These are uniform crime reporting statistics. I can tell you if you're any type of all computer literate, you can go right into the Department of Criminal Justice Services and run statistics whatever way you want for whatever groups you want for the last 4 or 5 years that will just point out crime statistics in this county by different agencies. The Civil Division, this gives you an idea of the civil processes we do. The Civil Division, like the jail, is a mandated function of the Sheriff's Office. And our main purpose is judgment collection, processing of civil service papers, and serving papers for family court and other entities like family court. The pie chart just gives you a breakdown of the different types of papers we serve.
Peter, I hate to do this. Can I ask you to move a little quicker?
Yep, we're almost done. This is more specific information on the civil process. And the pistol permits, just note on the pistol permit process that the number of pistol permits have increased in the last couple of years, as well as the number of amendments, which are changes or additions or deletions to someone's permit. Correction Division, as I stated earlier, we were first-time accredited. We received a variance back in the beginning of 2009 that's helped our capacity to 92 inmates. Jail makeup is all the functions that we report on annually, medical unit, administrative unit, library, kitchen, et cetera. The intake and booking, these charts give you a sense of how many people were brought into the jail. There's one chart by race. There's another chart by age. People commonly ask that, so I thought it would be a good idea to put this information up on an annual basis so people can take a look at it. Inmate programs, I think I already talked briefly about the reentry program. It's been a great program and a great success, and we continue to work with that. Correction Officer Potter, who's here with me, also put together our work release program where we allow certain people out providing community services. The last couple of years, we've worked with County Highway, and it's worked very well. Other correction things we do are the bails, where we do a credit card bail, and we do a victim information and notification system every day. When I first came into the office in 1999, there wasn't anything electronic, and we used to do what we call a pink hot sheet and essentially created our own Vine system where whenever we made an arrest or anybody was brought into the jail, we got the victim information and made sure that we contacted the victim before or as the people were being released from jail. Now it's all done electronically. Correction Division training just shows you we have almost 16 hours of training, standard training as well as some other miscellaneous trainings for another 110 hours. It gives each officer over 40 hours apiece. Awards and recognition, we are at the end. Stop DWI Award of Excellence for Deputy James Vann, Deputy Matt Hazelman, and Deputy Pete Walker, and Deputy Kyle Koskinen was awarded the Large Agency Outstanding DWI Officer of the Year in 2009, and he also was number one in the FBI Sniper School in the entire country. Officer of the Month, we nominated Kim Moore from ITS. She's been so helpful to us that we thought we would recognize her as one of us and the great work that she and Greg and that entire department do for the Sheriff's Office. Deputy Pete Walker and Deputy Dan Donahue for saving a life up at Grassroots. Deputy Jerry Hoffman for saving the life of a woman who tried to take her own. And Captain Derek Osborne for all the wonderful forms, policies, and operation help that he's given us.
Thank you very much, Peter. Would a lot of information here, and I'm sure people can call Peter after they've looked it over, but are there questions tonight? Will.
Thank you. Thanks, Peter. I would very much, would it be possible to send out the PowerPoint as a PDF? Because I literally could not read the charts and in this format.
Okay, the charts are all here in the book. Everything that's in that PowerPoint is just an abbreviation of the annual report itself.
Okay.
So every single thing you see in
I
the
actually was looking and didn't find all the financial charts. Are they all
in there? They're all in there, yep. Because we just pulled from the electronic version, and it's also on our website electronically.
And I was a little confused by the section executions and civil process fees. What we are talking about executions.
Executions, it's a term of law under a civil law. It typically is an income execution or property execution. Probably about 90 to 92% of all the executions, which essentially is a garnishment of wages against somebody that has a judgment debt, are income executions where you have so much percentage taken out of your income, depending on your income and the judgment itself. And then property executions are where you take property, either personal property or real property, and sell it based on the judgment.
Thank you.
Carol.
Thank you. This is really a meatier report with more charts than we've been able to have in the past, I think, and I really appreciate having them. Computers are great. I have just a quick question about the fines and forfeitures as a source of income. If I can read the figure correctly, page 8. In the breakdown of revenue. I don't need an exact figure, but I was just looking for what kinds of fines and forfeitures they are. It was $6,000, which would seem either not high enough or too high, depending on if the courts get most of the fines.
Well, typically it's reimbursement money. We don't get any fine money. It's reimbursement money, but that's what it's labeled as under the reporting, fines and forfeitures under the accounting system. So it's typically reimbursement from someone who may have damaged a vehicle of ours, not in an automobile accident, but somebody we had under arrest and they kicked out a window or something of that nature. It's typically that. That's what the fines and forfeitures are. It's the accounting term in our accounting system. It's just that's typically what's put inside there.
Okay, thanks. Mm-hmm. And Peter?
I have the same question that Carol just asked. Thank you.
Anyone else? Dooley.
Toward the end of your presentation, your agency was referred to as a large agency, which I had never thought of it that way before. What's the break-off between small and large agencies for sheriffs?
I think that's all over the board. I think it depends on who's quantifying it, whether it's federal government, the state government, sheriff's association, the individual agency. There's no
that's
parameter.
Confusing.
There's no parameter.
Okay. And I also read that inmates are allowed 2 one-hour visits a week. Is that something that the state says you have to do, or is that a level of visitation that's decided on locally?
That's the minimum mandate.
That's the minimum mandate.
Yes.
Thank you.
Anyone else? Thank you very much, Peter and
Thank
Master
you.
Potter. Thank you. For my report tonight, a couple of things. the broadband committee, that's a recommendation from the GO committee. I am working with Marshall Lynch on deadlines for applications. We'd like to open up, this will be a new advisory committee to the legislature through the GO committee. And we'd like to really have a public information process so people can apply. So I'm working with Marsha on the deadlines for that, and we expect to announce that within a couple of days. And again, if any legislators are interested, I've heard from a couple of people. Anybody interested, please let me know. I wanted to mention that next week, next Monday and Wednesday, are the rescheduled hearings by the EPA on hydrofracking. And in Binghamton, and I'll be speaking on Monday, and I think Pam and Carol, perhaps maybe other legislators are also going to, are also speaking at those hearings, and there's a press conference on Monday morning. I'll be part of that as well. So there's a lot going on with that. And I just wanted to highlight something. Of course, we've got our budget books here. And you'll hear from Joe about all that in a minute. But that's not all Joe and his staff have been doing. There are a couple of other resolutions on your agenda tonight that represent an incredible amount of work. And this is just kind of the end point. There's the retirement, the early retirement plan, the resolution on the tourism planner, and especially the health insurance consortium. And I just want to say that Joe and you and your staff have just been cranking out an incredible amount of work, and we really appreciate it. I know it's really hard to keep all these things going, and I'm glad at least a couple things are going to be, at least this phase of them, finished.
Thank
so
you.
I really
Thank
appreciate
you.
All that work. So with that, County Administrator's report.
Thank you, Martha, and really thanks for saying that. I have a few things in my report tonight. I will spend most of my time tonight, with your indulgence, going through the first presentation of the 2011 tentative budget. I'll do that at the end of my report so that we have plenty of time to go through that. I'll start out with, the easiest thing on my agenda. The United Way campaign is underway. It's being headed this year in the community by Alan Peterson from the Med Center. It's being headed within the county by Anita Fitzpatrick and the personnel department, who have taken up the charge. Pledge cards will be circulated in paychecks this week. And the overall effort is being kicked off with a food drive. So as we speak, there are bins being placed in county facilities, with the idea of trying to collect as much food as we possibly can that will all be brought to Stewart Park on September 16th and made a part of a community-wide food drive. So, as always, we appreciate what our employees and our legislators can do on this front. And again, the campaign is underway.
Excuse me, and Joe, there's a bin right in the lobby here, and if it looks like a recycling bin, that's what it is, but it's for those donations, and there's a list of the items that are appreciated.
That's great.
Thank you.
That's great. Second item on in my report tonight, I did want to report to you on the Road Patrol Arbitration Award. I think all of you received a briefing memo from me maybe last week that identifies the terms of that award. I just wanted to go through it very briefly tonight. First, so everyone knows, the Road Patrol Union, the uniformed members of the Road Patrol Union, are eligible for binding arbitration in negotiations. That makes them unique among our employees. We've been going through that process to resolve some of the oldest years of this of a contract that expired back in February of 2006. So the Road Patrol group has been without a contract since February of 2006. Through the arbitration process, both sides were able to present their case. An arbitrator finally issued an award, a decision, on August 21st. That award only covers a two-year period, the period from March 1st, 2006 to February 28th, 2008. It applies to 37 members of the Road Patrol Union, and it also covers, there have been several who have left county employment since those years went by. Under the terms of this award, they will also get the benefit of the adjustments that were made through the award. In terms of the major economic elements that are in the award, wage increases were granted in both years of 3.5%. Now, I think as we look at that and reconcile ourselves to it, we have to remember that this arbitration award is based on the conditions of that time. And the conditions of that time were such that the 3.5% wage increases seemed, in the eyes of the arbitrator and frankly, I think so too, were reasonable in light of the times that we were in back then. So again, it's 3.5% in each of the two-year period. There were a couple of changes elsewhere in this budget, in the award, beyond just wage growth. Minimum call-in time was granted, so if a deputy gets called in, usually for court time, a minimum of 2 hours overtime will be paid for that call-in time. Now, I believe that, for the most part, once called in, deputies usually spend at least 2 hours anyway, so this wasn't viewed as a significant change. Increases in the shift premium were granted of about a quarter an hour in the second year of the contract. Small adjustments were made in the clothing allowances, about $50 a year. There was also a slight bump, Frank, in longevity pay granted under the award, a $35 increase for those who have been here from 9 to 14 years and $180 a year for those who have been here for 15 years or longer. I think those are the major economic elements of the plan. In terms of legislation, because this is binding arbitration, there is no enactment of this by the legislature. The resolutions that will come before you are simply to move money from one account to another to make sure that we can make those retro payments that are due and also to provide the sheriff enough money in his line items to pay for these salary adjustments going forward. So again, that it resolves 2 years of the wages for the deputies that have been outstanding. There's a small group of civilian employees, support staff, that are also a part of this union, and those employees were not affected by this agreement, so those amounts are still outstanding. Those individuals are still outstanding in this agreement. That's something that we'll have to come back to.
Are there any questions about this before we go on to other things from Joe's report? Frank, then Pat, and Peter.
Joe, I appreciate the amount of effort that really has gone into this. It's been a long, protracted discussion. But I couldn't help hear the reference to the longevity piece. Because it was resolved by arbitration and it was implemented by, we don't really have a choice.
That's correct.
If the longevity piece as a part of the contract did not exist, could the arbitrator impose that, or because it exists, it, they have an opportunity to affect whatever is in that category?
I believe, Frank, the arbitrator couldn't put a new term in a contract out of thin air. However, if one side in these negotiations had put that on their list, the arbitrator would then have to react to it. So it could have been nothing to begin with. But the union may have said, we would like to begin receiving longevities. That's not the case here, but they could have done that. In that case, the arbitrator, I believe, would have an obligation to consider that argument and consider whether they want to actually make that a part of the contract.
If we wanted to pull that out of the contract, we would have to negotiate that out.
That's right. That would have to be in a subsequent negotiation. So as we go back to the table for those outstanding years in the future, if that's something that we wanted to get rid of or reduce, we would have to negotiate that benefit down.
Thank you.
Pat and then Peter.
Joe, could you speak a little bit about how the county plans for this type of situation, just in general terms? Have we, for instance, had money set aside or as part of the contingency fund or something in anticipation of this settlement? How do we manage now to pay for this settlement?
Right, we have set money aside, so in the budget every year there's typically money that's put in there in anticipation of that wage growth. When that money isn't spent, it goes into our fund balance. And I believe that David has designated some of our fund balance for the payment of this catch-up factor, this retroactive payment. So in terms of a lump sum payment, that's provided in our fund balance. We will draw from there, and we plan to draw from there. The other question is, have we ramped up our budget so that we can, it's not just a one-time payment, because our wages will go up now permanently.
Right.
Have we provided for that? And fortunately, the answer is yes. That in our budget, we have assumed a certain level of wage growth for this group of employees, knowing that at some point the arbitrator would issue an award. So we have ramped up our ongoing budget in a way that we will be able to pay these wages going forward without a shock to our taxes or our budget. It's built into our baseline.
Okay. Thank you. Peter.
I have a question. I'm not sure it's an appropriate question for open session, so please say so if it's not. But I'm interested in that 3.5% number and what the closing irreconcilable positions of both sides were when this was left to when this was given to arbitration. Namely, what did they want? What were they asking? What was their final ask, and what was our final offer?
I'm not sure that is appropriate for public session. We can talk about that in executive session and maybe talk about what some of the offers were that were made. But again, Peter, I think you're probably right. It's not an open session. Either.
Okay.
Is that a request for an executive session? We can.
No.
No, I can remember it. I'll remember the next time we have another executive session.
Okay. Thank you. Anyone else? Jim.
I just want to make one comment. You all recognize that it's a two-year award, and to call it an agreement is a misnomer. It's an award by a third party, and there are three people in the room, and people vote on how it's going to be awarded. So it's an award. And what the key thing to the award is, it ends in 08. And all of you can remember the world changed in 08 for municipalities all over New York State. So our next step is there will be a demand for negotiation on the part of this bargaining unit and every bargaining unit that we're with. And we have to go back to the table with them right soon. So we will be looking to do something for 08, 09, and 10. And,
thank you, Jim. Anyone else? Then on to the next topic.
There's no other questions on that. I'd like to take about 15 or 20 minutes tonight to do something that we did last year as the budgets were coming to you. And that's just to provide you a relatively brief overview of the 2011 budget, highlighting some of the things that are in there. Hopefully, look at that. since hopefully the PowerPoint works, because the PowerPoint is much more articulate than I am about this.
Question?
Yes.
Joe, is there something in the large budget book that we're supposed to follow?
Well, you know, there is a budget message. This is also something that we began last year. There's a budget message in the front of the budget, which is a letter from me that is a longer version of what I'm going to give you tonight. So if you want to, I will follow the same order as that. You will pick up more of the details and nuance in that than you will in this tonight. So maybe that's...
The letter will take us more than 15 minutes to read. That's a joke.
It might. And I know if I read it, it will take more than 15 or 20 minutes. And I do have prepared remarks just to make sure that I've disciplined the presentation well enough to get through in 15 or 20 minutes. And I'm not going to dwell on details. Over the next couple of months, you're going to have plenty of time to get into the details of this budget. Instead, what I'd like to do is to go over some of the major features of the budget in order to provide you with context, perspective, and a sense of some of the issues that are likely to dominate this year's budget discussion, and there are several. Before getting into the budget itself, I think it's important to spend a little time talking about... That's last year's.
That's why.
Although it's surprisingly similar to this year. I thought it was so good.
You know, I wasn't going to say anything.
And that's the Carrier Dome for the Villanova game, if you're interested in it.
That's not the Cornell-Kentucky game, is it?
No, but it's the preview of the public hearing.
Can we give this guy a new picture?
That brings back, but that particular slide brings back memories, Kevin.
This is just a check to see whether we were awake, I think, right? So. So while we're waiting, Marcia, are these documents online yet?
They are not. They will be. You want to buy it?
They will be as of tomorrow.
Okay. So for the public, you go to Tompkins County's website, and then there's the list on the right, and there's the click onto the budget items, and these documents and many, many other documents
right.
are there, right?
Right?
As of tomorrow morning.
That's right.
Thanks, Marcia.
There you go. There you go.
So again, by way of backdrop, what I'd like to do is spend a couple of minutes talking about the environment that's shaping our budget. And certainly every budget is affected by its environment. Ours continues to be shaped by an economy that hasn't really recovered from the near collapse in 2008. Unemployment, and this is local, remains high, with the latest local rate still at 6.3%. That's pretty good at a time when the national rate is in the mid-9s, but still well beyond what we're accustomed to in this community. To me, the most important number up there isn't the unemployment rate. It's the number of residents, the 3,500 residents who were without work in July. That's up 1,400 from pre-recession levels. As joblessness has grown, so have our temporary assistance caseloads. And not only are our caseloads staying at an elevated level, a growing number of our clients are receiving benefits through the safety net program. That's important because we pay half the cost of safety net benefits versus a quarter of the cost of the family assistance program. You've heard me say, probably too often, that I believe the number of people relying on food stamps is the best indicator of underlying economic stress and a dependence on public services. Food stamp cases in this county have grown in 30 of the last 32 months and have increased by 49% over the past 3 years. There are some other critical factors in our environment that are related to the economy, but in a somewhat less obvious way. Our pension costs are skyrocketing. A lot of people who hear about that probably think that's caused by over-the-top pension benefits provided to public employees, or perhaps even abuse in the system. But the real reason is that the state's pension fund lost $45 billion, that's 30% of its value, when the economy collapsed. Well, the market has gotten a little better. Only $15 billion of the losses have been recovered. That means the state has had to replenish its fund by charging employers more, substantially more, and that's why pension costs are soaring. The economy has also brought the New York state government to the brink. For 8 months this year, we watched as the state struggled to close a $9 billion deficit and probably still wonder whether that was really achieved. However, the state budget office now says that there's another $37 billion deficit around the corner. That's not good news for counties. We're the ones who deliver the state's human service programs and foot a significant portion of the bill. When the state's in financial trouble, it often takes the easy way out by reducing its cost by raising ours, avoiding the pain of reducing state services and the wrath of raising state taxes. But still, not everything in our environment is bad. After plummeting in 2009, sales tax revenue was showing consistent growth in 2010 and is expected to hit our budget target this year. Congress approved one last installment of the federal stimulus program that reduces our Medicaid costs. And we expect to begin processing our health benefits through an intermunicipal consortium on January 1st of next year, lowering our local cost of health benefits by nearly $250,000. In general, though, we're continuing to confront an anemic economy that's left us with a higher demand for our services and a diminished ability to pay for them. That environment's produced the challenges we're confronting in this budget. The cost of mandated programs is up by $1 million in 2011. Even under the so-called cap, Medicaid costs have grown by 3%. We're about $350,000. We're also projecting growth, some of it substantial, in the pre-K special education program, indigent defense, and temporary assistance. As I said earlier, and as we've been saying for months, pension costs are continuing to soar. We now know that our early projections, which we had hoped were too conservative, in fact, were very close to the mark, and that our pension bill next year will rise by 40%. That's after a 50% increase in 2010. This $1.7 million local impact is the largest cost factor in the 2011 budget, and projections suggest that we've not seen the last of increases in pensions. And last among the single factors affecting the budget is the state Senate's decision to embargo all home rule requests for local tax actions this year. That cost us $900,000 in new mortgage recording tax revenue we've been counting on for 2011. In all, we're facing a 2011 budget gap of nearly $5 million. I don't think any of us would suggest we try to close that gap only by raising taxes or only by cutting expenses. Instead, the tentative budget tries to find balance on many levels, especially the balance between the need for services and property tax restraint. The budget before you proposes a 5% increase in the county's property tax levy, consistent with the goal established by the legislature earlier this summer. The increase would address $1.9 million of the gap, costing the average homeowner $66 next year. The budget recommends spending cuts of over $2 million. I'll talk about those cuts in just a minute. And finally, I'm recommending we use our 2011 FMAP savings, basically the last installment of federal stimulus funds, to help balance the budget. I'm looking at the use of this one-time money as a placeholder for a recurring mortgage tax that I am reasonably confident we will begin receiving in 2012. Again, the goal was to address our budget challenge in a balanced way, and I believe that goal has been realized. As I said, the tentative budget includes over $2 million in spending cuts. Nearly every county program and service is affected by that, some through traditional belt-tightening measures, others in more profound ways. Most of the cuts in this budget are in the form of departmental over-target requests that could not be funded, that we did not have the means to support. Some, however, are unilateral reductions in target funding that I've recommended, using reductions in one area to fund what I believe are high priority and high impact OTRs in another. In making those recommendations, my priority has been on health, safety, and core governance. There are some areas that are particularly affected by spending reductions and that the legislature will probably be considering most carefully. Among the OTRs that have not been funded in the tentative budget are a number of child welfare programs within DSS that are provided by not-for-profit agencies. Of all the cuts in the tentative budget, this probably causes me the greatest concern. The probation department could not afford to continue the day reporting program within its target, and I was able to allocate only enough money to operate a half day rather than a full day program. The highway division is down by a full work crew. Downsizings and reorganizations have occurred in several departments and units within departments, and several value-added services and planning have been cut. As you review the OTRs, you will find many other things that had to be reduced or eliminated. And in some cases, departments cut spending and did not ask for those cuts to be restored through OTRs. They've simply been incorporated into their operations. Where I did recommend funding for the OTRs, I respected the priorities established by department heads. As I said, the tentative budget also includes unilateral reductions that I made in an effort to reallocate dollars to areas of greatest need and impact. As you know, the county operates a certified home health agency, or CHA, that provides in-home care to residents, most of whom are elderly. The local cost of that program is about $400,000 a year. The CHA is one of the very few programs that we can stop doing, eliminate all local dollars, and still be confident that our clients will continue to receive high-quality, attentive care through a qualified, not-for-profit home health agency. Over the past 2 years, 10 counties have decided to divest themselves of their CHA, and 18 others are currently considering it. I'm recommending that we set a goal of a CHA that is operated without a property tax subsidy. And I'm suggesting that we look first to our own operations, that we hire an outside expert to help us understand whether we can achieve break-even with our county-run CHA through cost reductions and revenue enhancements. If that's not possible, I'd recommend we transfer our interest in a CHA to a high-quality, not-for-profit home health care provider who will operate without a local subsidy. Again, no client, current or future, would lose service if this were to happen. The tentative budget assumes that we'll be able to eliminate the local dollar cost by mid-year next year. The budget also recommends the elimination of funding for the Youth Services Department's Municipal Youth Development Program and a reduction in funding for the Community and Career Apprenticeship Program. The Municipal Youth Development Program raises $250,000 through the county property tax levy, which we then give to municipalities to support their after-school and other youth development programs. Municipalities match our money with theirs and often generate other outside contributions. The program does good things for young people and is well regarded by our municipal partners. However, the growth of mandated and uncontrollable costs greatly limits the county's ability to raise property taxes on behalf of other property taxing jurisdictions. And with critical services being curtailed to meet budget targets, we simply can't afford to do all that we have in the past. This too applies to my recommendation to reduce funding for the Community and Career Apprenticeship Program. I will note that even with these proposed reductions, our local dollar contribution to youth services will remain several times higher than that of the largest counties in New York State. There are a few initiatives that I'd like you to consider as a part of the budget proposal, including a three-year, $2.4 million program financed by county bonds to address our deferred capital maintenance needs. This will ultimately reduce the cost of maintaining our facilities. I've put $100,000 in one-time money in the budget to begin planning for that project. The contingency fund includes a small amount of money to review ways to more cost-effectively maintain our system of county and municipal roads, highways, and bridges. The budget also recognizes the importance of energy conservation, climate change, and sustainability, and the central role our planning department has taken in those issues. On your agenda tonight, you're also being asked to add the tourism function to the planning department. In light of those changes, the budget proposes the creation of a new title of Commissioner of Planning and Community Sustainability. As that title implies, the position would no longer provide executive oversight to our four public works divisions. Instead, I recommend that we evaluate the effectiveness of having those division managers report directly to me, with coordination continuing to be provided through the Public Works Cabinet. As a part of this change, we would fill a long vacant engineering position in the Highways Division, addressing a widely held desire to increase our in-house engineering capacity. So no budget is complete without numbers, so to the numbers. In addition to their target requests, departments submitted over-target requests for $3.4 million, including the restoration of target funding that I proposed to cut. The tentative budget funds 1.5 million of those requests. The money to put behind that restoration came from essentially two places. $780,000 from the use of the one-time FMAP money, the federal stimulus money, and the rest of it through the reductions in target spending that I proposed in the CHA and new services. Without those changes, there would have been almost no money to fund any OTR. The departments have also asked for the use of about $500,000 in rollover and one-time money, almost always for one-time expenses. I've recommended a similar amount, but have made some small department-by-department adjustments. So in total, the OTRs total $3.9 million, and about $2 million of that is funded in the budget, leaving $2 million in cuts that were not restored in this budget. Our capital plan for next year is austere, with $100,000 supported with ongoing target dollars and another $270,000, mostly for the local share of highway projects funded with one-time money. Governments are labor-intensive, so reducing spending in any government usually requires a reduction in the workforce. This budget supports a roster of 741 FTEs, a reduction of 20, or 2.6%, from 2010. This number assumes the CHA will continue next year as a break-even county operation. Last year, we also reduced the roster by nearly 3%. Most of those 20 positions are currently vacant. Based on current estimates, it looks like about five positions would be subject to a layoff. But if the retirement incentive that we have on tonight's agenda passes, hopefully even that number may drop. Since every budget is based on assumptions, there are risks in this budget that we need to acknowledge. We've assumed that sales tax will grow 3% this year and another 2% next. To hit that target, the economy needs to be continuing its recovery. I've assumed that you will ask for and the state will approve another two-year extension of our 1% sales tax, and that the state will also approve our home rule request for a mortgage recording tax in time for the full proceeds to be realized in 2012. The budget is based on current levels of state aid and temporary assistance caseloads, and it assumes that any cost increases from wage settlements will be fully offset with savings. In terms of the general outcomes of this proposal, the budget meets our fiscal targets. It closes the gap through a balance of revenue increases and spending decreases. Our approach to spending reductions is oriented more this year toward programs than it has been in the past, consistent with the recognition that a purely across-the-board approach often can't move resources across departmental lines to areas of greatest need. But still, with the cuts that have been made, county staff will still have to continue doing more with less. And finally, to the bottom line, the budget holds our spending total to the same $156 million as in 2010. Local spending is up by just 0.6%. The property tax levy is up 5% as planned over 2010. And the property tax rate, because of changes in our tax base, is up by 6.8%, or 41 cents per thousand. That change in the tax base was due largely to the shift of AES from a taxable entity to a pilot entity. If you approve this budget, as I doubt you will, the average homeowner would see a $66 per year increase in his or her 2011 county tax bill. As we begin the process of legislative review of this budget, I'd like to sincerely thank and recognize the department heads and the county staff who worked hard and creatively to develop the budget that tries to respond to these very difficult times we're in. I'd like to acknowledge the work of Kevin Sutherland, who did a great job in his first budget in trying to pull all this together, and he has. And I also appreciate the guidance of the legislature, which has provided me good advice since we began to think about the 2011 budget, which, as I recall, was about a week after we finished the 2010 budget. So as we begin this process, we look forward to working with you to turn this proposal into a final plan for the county. And that's my report. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Joe. We probably all have questions. Would you like to take some questions now?
We do that now, and again, a lot of the details we'll be able to address in the expanded budget committee, which will begin meeting next week.
Could you just put that slide back up, the last one? Thank you.
You want the next one?
Joe, I'm sorry, Frank, and then Peter.
You know, I'll have a million questions, but one thing for clarity. I think every time we make a presentation, we need to emphasize that this is the county budget, and any increase is what people should expect on their county taxes, because there's so much confusion about what's driving taxes, and we know a lot of it is the school tax. So just for sake of discussion, I think that might be
a good point.
Something for clarity. Joe, have you or Kevin developed a, I know you've been, this is a lot of work, and you really ought to be lauded for what you've done. A lot of us have harassed you guys for the last several months. Is there a possibility that as we go through this, we can see what a 1% either way might do if we increased it to a 6% or a 7% or reduced it to a 4% or a 3%, what that might translate to?
In terms of both impact on the budget and the impact on a homeowner, is that what you'd like to see?
And how much money that, based on your projections, how much money that might represent, so we have some idea. If we wanted to restore something, what are we looking at in dollars that we could?
I know that 1% on levy is worth about $380,000. So if we were to go to 6%, for example.
$380,000. Thanks.
Okay. I think, Peter, you had your hand up?
Yeah, I did. These are general questions about things I didn't that surprised me on this graph, in this presentation. Number one, the sales tax I find totally confusing. When you show the numbers on the sales tax, I'm be damned if I can see any kind of a cliff that we fell off in 2008. It looks to me just sort of flat, with little ups and downs. And I'm just sitting here wondering why you would expect to see a 2 or 3% over the next couple of years. Why ought it to be going up? That's question number one.
Okay. Actually, I can probably get back to the slide, Peter, but there was a significant drop in 2009. So we had been experiencing good, solid growth 2006, 2007, 2008, and then, in fact, we did fall off the cliff.
Yeah, we dropped off.
And dropped off by a couple million. We had
Right, but then it went right back up again. So.
Well, no. I mean, it's going up now, and that's the last bar that you'd see in that chart, and it's going to take forever to get back to that slide.
Oh, okay.
But we are seeing, and David's been reporting on this, we have seen five consecutive months of growth in the sales tax. We needed to make a 3% growth factor this year to hit our budget target, and it looks like we will. So that becomes our foundation. We believe that we will... Getting close. We believe we'll hit that budget target this year. And then we will build on top of it next year. There you go.
All right, there's the sales tax.
There you go. But see how in 2009, and this created a critical problem for the county when our revenues fell by $2 million. So now we're growing back from a diminished base.
Okay, I see what you say, but you know, the way, if I just saw that data not even knowing what it was, and someone said to me, is that consistent with something flat at 24? And I'd say, yeah, it looks all right. It looks sort of flat over 4 years at 24. I'm just telling you the way I react to that.
We should do a better job explaining this. And by the way, just as a quick comment, it's really important this revenue grow. This is one of the very few revenues in our budget that grows with the economy and helps us pay for growth in our budget. If it doesn't grow, we've got issues. So that's why the restoration of growth is so important.
Okay, that was question number one. Question number two is, somehow I was surprised to find that that with your 5% cut, that the levy is constant between 2010 and 2011. I haven't quite internalized that, but that's not what I expected to see. The very last slide you showed the...
Well, the levy is going up by 1.9 million. So local spending is flat.
Local spending is flat.
Right.
Yeah, that's the local spending is flat. And right. I can't quite reconcile that with a 5% budget cut. Maybe you can say a few soothing words to make me see.
Well, we can go through the details. It just means that we're relying more on the local property tax. We're paying for a higher share of local spending with our local property tax. So it's a shifting burden to the property tax.
From what?
From things like rapidly growing sales taxes. There's less in the way of reserves applied in this budget than in the prior budget, because we don't have the capacity to put as much in the budget in the way of reserves as
That's
we did
the reserves.
Before.
Okay, yeah, that always.
So we can go through again.
Okay, all right. I don't want to take a lot of time. The third thing that I wonder if you could get a quick answer to this is that I'm sure there's an easy one to this. I'm not quite understanding with these over target requests. Now you've said you've granted some over target requests. Now, if we say okay, I accept all your over target requests, then if we do no more over target requests, then everything will end up stable.
Everything will end up just as you see it here.
Right. But if we do grant more over-target requests, where is that going to come from?
You will have to do one of three things. You'll have to either raise taxes above the level that I proposed, or you will have to reduce other spending in areas that I have not proposed. And the last is you could draw on reserves and spend down balances, which will create liquidity issues. So those are really the only three levers that you have to work with.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
All right. Mike, then Pat, then Carol.
I just wondered how extensive a conversation we're going to get into on this tonight, since we're about to embark on the expanded budget committee, where we'll be going through all of these items in much more detail, including how the revenues are structured. Just wondered, are we going to... replay it here in advance?
I think a few questions are appropriate. I think the public is already going to be paying attention and asking all of us questions. Our first expanded budget committee meeting is next Monday, every one of these conversations goes into another layer or two or four of detail. But I think a few more questions are in order. And I'm going to put myself in after Carol if she doesn't ask my question. So was that your whole question? Okay, Pat?
I just wondered, and it kind of follows in line with what Mike asked, if you could just give a brief synopsis of process from here on, since we now have, this is in some ways a starting point. Where does it end up, and how do we get there?
Turn that over to the chair of the budget committee, Jim Dennis.
And I will do that during the budget committee report.
Okay, Carol?
Yeah, I would assume that one of the concerns of both our department heads and the public, for those departments for whom you're recommending coming in under further reduction below their target, whether we have any or to what extent that becomes permanent. In the same way that when we raise something, once it's raised, that's the new target, and the following year we're looking at, do we raise it above that? Do we have any mechanism? And I don't know if you need to answer it now, but as we get into the budget process, if you'd rather answer it then, that's okay too. But I'm going to be wanting to know if we have any mechanism whereby for those programs that we're saying we just can't afford this year, there's any process whereby we can say you're first on the list to be put back in a following year, or I mean, I know we can't make decisions for future year, but once you're under target, does that in every case become a new target for the future years, or do we have any mechanism to do it any other way?
Well, certainly the legislature has the latitude in any year to change funding levels. So if, for example, any of these cuts that I'm proposing, you would agree with this year, you could certainly revisit it next year if the situation changed. I'll be honest, it's more difficult once that money is gone to get it back. We can't pretend it's not. But you always have the prerogative to do that in a subsequent year. Can anything formally be put into the budget? I think it compromises that rule that you're not allowed to bind future legislators. So there may be some issues there.
We have a mechanism whereby if we want to fund something, or we have in the past, that's over the target, we have decided to use rollover to do so, or one-time money, so that it, you know, if we're not building it in. So is there any similar mechanism to take something out, but in a way that is less than permanent? We have it on the one direction.
Well, it's something we can explore over the next couple of months. I know we talked about it a little bit last year. I don't think we really ever got to the finish line on that discussion. We can bring it back.
I had an idea last year of sort of a one-time cut, and it didn't end up materializing into anything that we actually used. But, my question is quick. I think the average home, Joe, what is usually we talk about?
Yeah.
$100,000 home, but what is
this? This we've used what we believe is the average value of a home, which is $160,000.
So in Tompkins County, the average home is $160,000.
Right.
So that's the increase on that home, on
yes.
The taxes, on the
right.
Dollars. Okay. Thank you very much, Frank.
Go ahead. I want to follow up on something else, but I think.
I didn't see any other hands. Was there anyone else? Brian?
I do, but I don't. It's more of a small comment rather than a question. I mean, we've been on the budget committee, and I've gotten this good cheer for months, so I've already heard it.
Right.
Obviously, I've never been through this with this body before, but I'm going to guess that in a couple of months, we're going to be able to fumble through this somehow and get to a point where we're going to agree on something. That I'm confident in. What I'm not so confident in is that's this year. I look at things more down the road than just what's in front of me. And, I see state mandate increases that are going to continue, pension rates that are, as far as I can tell, are probably going to double from what they are right now within a couple of years. FMAP, we have $780,000 in FMAP money that we're not going to have in the future. We've got something that we're going to discuss a little bit later, and that it's... politically, it's a great thing to bring up, but we may very well get saddled with a 2% cap on what we can tax. All those added up make this look pretty rosy this year. not a great thought to have to think about, but. Maybe we should be looking at that as we proceed this year. And that's just a comment that I have.
Thanks a lot, Brian.
Well,
no, you're absolutely right. Absolutely right. Nathan and then Frank.
Yeah, I echo what Brian's saying, and that's why I'm actually very
impressed with this budget that we are finally addressing, looking at whole programs. Because for years we've just looked at cutting away 1 or 2% here and there, and you do that over 10 years, and you have a program that's so inefficient because it has so few funds and so few people, they can't do the job that it needs to do. I mean, you have to actually look at cutting whole programs if you want to reduce spending in the long run. And I think that it's brave that we're actually doing that in this budget, and I'm definitely open to considering it because it needs to be done.
Frank.
Two questions, Joe. One is serious and one is open for your interpretation. You made one assumption that the state is going to keep things pretty level and there won't be any further cuts. In your gut, how serious, I mean, do you really think that is? I mean, do you really think... Yeah. That's an assumption, I understand.
It is an assumption, and I worry a lot about the state and that projection that was in the Ithaca paper. I mean, they've adjusted their own projections by 31% over the past few months to the worse. So the state definitely has problems. The challenge when you put a budget together, though, and in dealing with that is, should you assume the worst? Should you assume that we'll lose $1 million of state aid and preemptively raise taxes or cut services? Or should you just remain nimble after the budget goes in place and be able to react to that pretty quickly? So looking ahead, I don't know whether they will cut $25,000 or $2.5 million. I don't know. And it's dangerous when you set up a budget to presume anything because you don't want to overtax and you don't want to cut prematurely. You just have to tell yourself if change happens, we have to be nimble and decisive when that comes.
Okay. Second is, at some point, we usually get a projection of some sort from David as to what we can expect or what his best guess is on the increase in assessments, what he thinks things may look like. Any large projects coming on that we can anticipate over the... And I'm going where Brian is going, and it may not just be for next year. But what are we looking at perhaps over a 2 to 4 year or 2 to 3 year? Anything that might adjust the assessment so that we can anticipate a little more income over a broader base?
I think that would be a good exercise, Frank. I don't have anything in my files right now, but it might be a good exercise to look at some of the projects that are on the drawing boards and see what they might do to base.
I mean, and conversely, any projects that we've heard about or anticipate that might reduce the tax base because they qualify for some sort of an exemption of some sort.
Okay. Dooley.
Is there a portion of this document that is the capital budget?
Yes, there's a page in the line item budget, or pages in the line item budget.
In part of your presentation, you were talking about bonding for deferred maintenance.
Yes.
And that was for buildings, I think.
Yes.
But allowing $100,000 to begin planning for that. So I couldn't follow you whether you meant there will be bonding next year to begin this deferred maintenance program, or whether it will be a year after that will take place.
I think we're going to want to spend some time to make sure that we have sized this the right way and we've got the right balance of projects. So for that reason, I've put $100,000 in for planning. So before we go out and actually borrow the money, we'll need to figure out what that plan is going to be, what the elements will consist of, and then go out and bond. So this is basically front-end money for that. Now, I'd have to check with David. It's conceivable that if you do front-end money like that, you might be able to get that money back when the bond is issued because it's kind of planning money. We would have to look at that. But this is really to jumpstart the effort.
And not actually bond any program in 2011.
It's conceivable that you would bond it in 2011, but I would think it's probably in the latter part of the year.
I hope you do it sooner rather than later.
We'll talk to Ed Marks as a part of this. This is something he and Arell have been working on.
Something else, Peter?
Me?
Yeah.
Yeah. Have we ever decided that we're going to do that bonding of, I mean, it, you know, when I heard about that, I thought, boy, that's the greatest invention since sliced bread. That really sounded good to me. But the more I thought about it, the more I started to think that it sounds to me like one of the really bad sins of government, namely paying for current expenses by bonding.
So I think that's the kind of discussion we'll have later on in September and October.
Okay. But
so, yeah, I was interested in sort of structural questions, and so I, if there are any others like that or comments, sort of overall, big picture. I would just make one big picture comment and say that if you look at the 2010 to 2011 local spending, it's essentially flat, $74 million and $74.4 million, at a time when our pension costs are going up the equivalent of a 4% levy, and Medicaid alone, not to mention other mandates, is also going up the equivalent of a 1% levy. So this certainly is a budget, as I'm sure we'll get into it, is really disciplined and a very, very tight budget that we haven't seen before.
Martha, something you just said about the pension costs. DiNapoli just came out with a, just in the last day or so, since Friday, with a report that changed what comprises the mix to decide what the pension cost percentage increase will be. Have you had any inkling as to, this was, I just read it.
He just released the projected rates, and again, we were at 16.1% in our planning, and that's what we've put in the budget. His final rate is more like 16.3%. He's also decreasing his expectations about return on investment for the fund.
7.5.
It used to be that he needed to make 8%, and at 8% return on investment, our normal rate, our pension rate, would be 11%. If we ever get back to normal, he'd get 8% on his money, and we'd pay 11% of payroll. He's now reduced that to 7.5%, I think.
Right.
Which the flip side of that coin is, that means that our rates are going to be higher in the future, even when life gets back to normal, than 11%.
Well, Joe, is that 16% you just mentioned, is that for 2011 or 2012?
Well, it's funny, because you will read it as 2012. Now, that's a bill that's formally due in, I think, February of 2012, but actually, you know, we pay it in December, and I think there's a so-called discount that goes along with it, which it isn't a discount. It means you pay a penalty when you pay it on time. It's crazy. But it is the 2011 bill.
It's a 2011. Thank you. Sorry, Martha.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much, Joe. Anything else in your report?
No.
Okay. We'll be looking at these numbers for a lot of hours in the next couple of months. Thank you very much. County Attorney's report, Jonathan?
I'll be somewhat shorter. I wanted to let everybody know that the sale of Bigsby has been completed. We got a check from the hospital for $1,053,646.80. And that's my report.
Can you do that again?
Get us another 1 million voices.
Sure. At least repeat the report. Thank you very much, Jonathan. David, Finance Director. David Squires.
Mike, I think Mike has a question.
Okay, hold on, David. Mike.
I'll just ask David when he's done with the report.
Okay. All right. Go ahead, David.
The one piece of good news is that New York State, for change during August, essentially caught up in reimbursing us for social service cost. We got $4 million during the month of August from New York State. In prior months, we were getting about $400,000 a month. So that was very helpful, though we have not seen any consistency in payments of other services, like for health department or probation. Those are always 8-10 months in arrears. Marcia indicated she was going to have the budget posted this week. Today I got the final audit, which we're going to be posting at the end of sometime this week. The county ended the year in fairly good shape, though I will say that our financial position has narrowed, and it's not going to provide any great assistance in making budget decisions in 2011. Our fund balance remains pretty stable, but it did go down in the general fund by $1 million, and our cash position declined to a minuscule level where it should be. We're down to the $10 million point at the end of 2009, which is the as low as we should need to go. And our cash position has been gradually going down over the last 3 years, but the budget has been going up. And so that's producing significant strains, and that's why I make the comment that the fund balance is not going to be of much assistance in planning next year, because we really are stretched very tightly on our liquidity. And finally, tomorrow we will be receiving bids on notes to finance Ellis Hollow Road and the upgrade of the computer aided dispatch and records management system at the for public safety. And I do not think we will. We're going to be converting all our outstanding notes to bonds before the end of the year. That'll be about $17 million worth. And this notes we're financing tomorrow are going to be short term. I'm saying that I doubt very seriously where we will get the same interest rate we got earlier in the year, which is the lowest of it's like 0.35%. So that was for 365 days, and we're going to. And I do not think we'll get that lower rate just for 90 days. Just simply the fact that the market, even though the market rates are zero on interest earnings, we haven't seen anything near 0.35% coming from note sales.
All right. So, any questions for David? Mike.
Just some sort of logistics question. I realize the money from the sale of Biggs has been planned for use in the health department, the building project. Do we park that somewhere for a while, or do we have to send it out the door right away?
Well, it's being held to pay down the $10 million of financing on the building. So we anticipate that in December, when the notes come due for the $10 million, we'll reduce that down to permanently finance less money.
So there's $10 million in BANs?
Yes.
Bond
outstanding
anticipation
right now,
notes?
Yeah.
So we won't, we'll just bond for
less.
$8 million or something.
Yes.
At that point.
Correct.
Thank you.
Anything else for David? Thank you very much, David. Was that your question for Jonathan, Mike?
Yes. That,
okay. Okay, great. Thank you. Are there any resolutions to be added to or withdrawn from the agenda? All right, I'd like to go through the consent agenda and then take a break before we start on committee reports and other resolutions, if that's okay. To start, I have a couple of chair's appointments, which are in your packet. They don't need to be added to the agenda, but because they are chair's appointments. Michael Lane and Carol Kamen have agreed to co-chair the Civil War Commission, and thank you very much for that. And Danny Lee Willer is being appointed to the Civil War Commission, and his application is in your folder also. Carol?
Just a question about that. We had discussed before reviewing what the charge to that commission had been and that we're proceeding as charged and to get a report on that. Is there a mechanism to hear back about that?
Yeah, there will be reports back.
Mike? There's a meeting scheduled for the 29th of September of the commission. I think we could probably respond to that better after that meeting.
And that reports the GO committee, right?
Correct.
Okay. All right. Thank you. So appointments on the consent agenda. Hillview Road Landfill Citizens Advisory Committee, Ernest Berry, and Criminal Justice Advisory ATI Board, Gwen Wilkinson. On resolutions, if you have anything, if you'd like it off, just please make that comment. Resolution A, and there's a slight correction in the manifest error, acceptance of a United States Department of Agriculture grant to provide waste reduction and recycling assistance for rural mobile home parks and apartment complexes Tompkins County Solid Waste Management Division, and the correction is on line 16, whereas the TCS WMD will serve as lead agency, is the way the verb form shall read. Resolution B, award of contract, laboratory monitoring and analytical services. ID number 2190, oh, that's just the resolution number. Resolution C, authorization to execute funding agreement with New York State Department of Transportation Covered Bridge Preservation Project. Resolution D, award of tourism capital grant. Resolution E, award of contract for arts and culture development, State Theater Incorporated. Resolution F, authorization to increase hours, outreach worker, office for the aging. Resolution G, approval of amended bylaws of the Tompkins County Board of Health, Health Department. And that's the consent agenda. I have a motion. Frank moves it. Is there a second on the consent agenda? Dave seconds. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Thank you. That is consent agenda. And before we start on the first committee report, which will be facilities and infrastructure, let us take a
Martha?
5-minute break. Yes, Mike?
I just wanted to say Steve DeWitt is waiting patiently here for Resolution J. Is there any possibility we could take that before we go on break? Or do you prefer not to?
I think that's a good idea. I looked around at the staff, and I wondered if anybody was waiting for something, so I didn't notice that. Why don't you go ahead, Mike, with Resolution J?
This is Resolution J, having to do with Board of Elections. Change in position, Board of Elections, and I so move.
Second. Jim seconds. Any discussion? Duly.
In the second whereas, I hope it would be acceptable to identify Mr. Palangeli as the, I think it's the Deputy Democratic Election Commissioner, and that's in line four, and in line six, if other members of the Board of Elections, I think the words of elections
that's,
need to be in
both of those are friendly.
Okay, Kathy, have us. Leslin?
I just had a question about the first resolved and the effective date. Is that accurate? January 1st, 2010. So it's something that's retroactive.
Yes, I believe that's correct. Steve, do you want to speak to that?
The date was inserted in there, I think, at the GO meeting.
Right.
And I think there was a concern among members of the GO committee that this should be retroactive. And it's an effort to do that, but I think in reality it's going to probably end up not being retroactive.
We wanted to say that we understood that he made took a voluntary reduction. We didn't think he should be penalized because we had not taken the action of actually changing the position.
Okay.
And that's why we asked for that date. We aren't sure whether or not we can make it retroactive, but we'd like to try to if we could.
Okay.
So it's a try to. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Anybody else? Ready to vote? All in favor of the resolution, please raise your hand. Any opposed? That's unanimous. Thanks,
Thank
Mike,
you.
For the catch. Thank you, Steve, for waiting. All right, let us come back here at 7:45. We're in recess. Thank you.